This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector. Investigative conversations about issues that impact our lives. Be curious. Friday mornings at 9 a.m. only on 101.9 Chai FM.
And this is indeed the Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and we are continuing, as we do every week, to give you a variety of things to think about. And, of course, we don't have a whole lot of choice in some ways. This is a year of elections, not just in South Africa, not just in the United States. There are something like 70 elections that are being determined this year. Each of them has political and economic issues and social realities. But today we're going to be a little tighter on South Africa's questions, but not on the horse race, not on who's going to win and who's going to lose. But what I like to do with guests who know things and understand them is get a sense of the underlying textures of things. How are the issues framed? What do those issues mean? And most importantly, what are the implications of solutions or remedies being proposed by various political actors? And today's guest, Professor Theo Venter, political and policy specialist, strategic facilitator, and scenario expert. That means he predicts the future, I think, and looks at a crystal ball and says, this is what's going to happen. And he's now at the University of the Free State, and he was previously at Northwest University's business school, and he became highly recommended to me by an old friend and neighbor, and actually neighbor of ours, Raymond Parsons, who just lives down the street from me. It's my fate in life to live in a suburb which has all kinds of experts and thought leaders. And Theo has lectured on strategy and scenario methodology, and he's been a special advisor for two of Northwest University's vice chancellors right from the beginning of the amalgamation, I guess, 2004 through 2016. And he has an active life as a political commentator on South African politics, and he served as an resident analyst for Network 24 during the local government elections that were most recently held. He's got a special interest in American politics as well, and he was a Fulbrighter at State University of New York in Albany, where he was there 1982 to 1984, a particularly fraught period in American politics. And he regularly comments on radio, on television, and print media, including issues of agriculture and agricultural economics. It's a delight to have you with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And I must say, the 2 years that I've spent in Albany, and that is a giveaway, the fact that you said Albany and not Albany, because I almost didn't got to Albany when I arrived in the U.S., because typical South African, I pronounced it as Albany, and the guys just looked at me whether I'm totally lost. And I was there when I studied in the days of Governor Cuomo, the dad of Cuomo that later became New York governor as well, son. And the other son, of course, on CNN that lost his job for whatever reason. Very interesting times.
Yeah, well, Mario Cuomo, the governor you're talking about, was often referred to as Hamlet on the Hudson, because Albany, of course, is on the Hudson River, and Mario Cuomo had this, I'm going to run for president, maybe, or maybe I'll be a third baseman for the New York Mets. So he famously got the sobriquet of Hamlet on the Hudson. Would have been a heck of a candidate for president, but there are some who argue that if he had run, the Republican operatives would have found some tenuous, deep, dark, ultimately eighth-hand connection to something to do with the mafia.
It's not only the mafia and the very strong immigrant societies like the Italians and a few others, but as a Afrikaans-speaking South African, I found upstate New York especially intriguing due to the legacy of the Dutch heritage that is still around in names, towns, places, farm names and things. And I felt quite at home in the suburb I lived that was called Gelderland. We, of course, would have pronounced it Gelderland. And that was just next to the Hildebergs, which we would have called the Helderbergen, which was great fun for me then.
Yeah, no, well, the Dutch were there in that part of New York State for the better part of 100 years. And all through that area, they, in later times, in the novels of James Fenimore Cooper and then even later Edith Wharton, there are the traces of the last parts of the Dutch legacy in terms of people, earlier layers of immigrants who tried to retain their place.
Let me just one last thing that I picked up there. I was invited to the Albany Museum where they had a project in translating 17th century Dutch to English so that people can access the court documents and things like that. And I was fascinated to discover in the United States of America that as an Afrikaans-speaking native, I can read 17th century Dutch as if it's modern Afrikaans. And I then realized that we grew up in South Africa with this romantic view that Afrikaans is a combination of three or four languages that formed in this and that. When I saw the language written in 1652, 1648, whatever, it is as close to Afrikaans that we speak today as it can be. In other words, the view that I developed then was that Afrikaans is kind of a piece of Dutch that got isolated at the southern part of the African continent, indigenized a few things, but for 80%, it is the Dutch that was spoken in the 17th century, and you can see it in the museum at Albany at the Rockefeller. They've got a major Rockefeller kind of set up there. But so I learned in America something about South Africa.
Well, we're going to have that conversation another day because that's always fascinated me. I spent a lot of time in Indonesia. I spent years and years there. And there are traces of Indonesian words in South African Afrikaans. Aren't too many bananas grown in the Netherlands, I don't think. And the word here is what? What do we call them here? We call them a pisang, and that's what they call them in Indonesia, too. If you don't mind, let's move away from comparative linguistics, although I'd love to stay there in a way. But let's talk to the question of elections and the electoral system and what it all means. We are really sort of neck deep in the elections process here. There, unlike America, there aren't any primaries, and parties develop their lists of who they're going to nominate for the national parliament. But I'm more interested in what are the key drivers of the thoughts of voters? What are voters thinking about? And then as a corollary to that, what is driving the proposed policies or remedies that the political parties are offering? I know that's a big topic. That's 2 hours worth of discussion. But if you can do it in 4 or 5 minutes, that would be good too.
Okay.
But can I interrupt you for one before I let you think about that for a second?
Okay.
Because I have to go to a station break, I am told. The station is in Johannesburg. I'm in Cape Town today, and I think you are down this part of the world as well today. So I'm getting hand signals in the air about what I'm supposed to do. And so let's go to a station break. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector. My guest today, Theo Venter.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
Um, we posed a question to our guest about the upcoming election, the key drivers of voter ideas, as well as the proposed remedies, solutions, and plans of parties, rather than specifically what one candidate is saying. Theo, your reaction to my question or your thoughts on the matter?
Yeah, I think if we were to put South Africa in context among the 70 elections that take place this year, which of course is a debate for another day, the biggest one being India and the most important one probably the US, I think South Africa, in my view, as an emerging democracy, we're still trying to sort out exactly who does what and who votes in what pattern. Now, one thing that has emerged over the last 30 years is that our election outcomes, we're using, of course, proportional representation, which presents, in my view, a much fairer outcome of party support and not the previous system of first past the post, which has its own inbuilt weird outcomes, and we have had several of them. But with proportional representation, the outcome of the election were basically that we had one big party. In political science, we prefer to call it a dominant one-party system. In other words, one party usually wins. Then we have a second party, not competitively so, but a second biggest party. Usually, it used to be the National Party, and then it became the DA. And then we've got a third party that challenges the second party in terms of size. It used to be the IFP, and then it was replaced by COPE and eventually replaced by the EFF. So you've got these three parties, and then you've got several smaller ones. I call them the 1% and the 2% parties. Now, in other systems that uses proportional representation, they add a kind of a hurdle, saying everybody can participate, but until you get 3 or 4% of the vote, you're not going to be represented in parliament. We don't do that. Everybody is represented. The moment you've got at least 50,000 votes in an election, you will have one seat, which, of course, created the system where we now have 14 parties in parliament, of which only two or three really can swing the vote. Now, if you look at voting and voting support, it's fascinating to see that the ANC over a period of 30 years has never had support among the white constituency in the country of more than 2%. It oscillates between 1% and 2%, and they've got like 80% support among black constituents. The DA, the current second biggest party, has never had more black support than maybe 10%. But it has like 80% white and to a large extent colored support. So you can see that one of the underlying trends in South African politics is definitely race or racial affiliation, or some people may call it identity politics. So there's an underlying current of what goes on in politics. And then on top of that underlying current, you have issues. And the issues has moved. And one of the most interesting things that happened over the last 10 years in South Africa is that in previous elections, it was possible to distinguish between what is a national problem and what is a local problem. But since Jacob Zuma took over and the state started falling apart and the state capture era, local and national issues started to basically integrate. If you now talk about service delivery and a politician talks about service delivery, it can be any of seven or eight things that he means by that, but you can use that at the national level when you refer to load shedding with Eskom, or you can refer to a water problem, which is a national problem, but it can also be a local problem. So we are in a process at the moment where these things are really very confusing, especially if you look from the outside in. But I think the biggest trend that we have seen over the last 30 years, because this election is a very special election. Now, I know we as political analysts, and I've been doing this since 1988, we like to call every election special. We like to call every election as the most important one. But I think this one, after 30 years, three decades of a democratic project, is very significant. It is significant because for the first time, we have independent participants in the election that does not support a political party, which is a funny animal to be accommodated in a proportional system, but that was a court decision. And in the second case, we've got, after 1994, we have one generation of politicians that came through, and we're actually emerging with a second generation. And if you look at other regime changes around us, you will see that the big changes actually happen after the first generation. In a regime change, whoever got the credit for the liberation or the independence or the freedom or whatever you want to call it away from what was typically a colonial situation, they have a honeymoon of about 25 to 30 years, and then the rot sets in the dominant party. And we are just at that point at the moment. So if you look at survey research, you'll see the ANC is flirting around the 50% mark. And they are currently represented in parliament with 57% of the vote. So if the survey research are correct, the ANC will at least lose 7% of their support, which is major. The second reason why this election is so important is that we have, for the first time, a break in the ANC with the so-called MKP, the MK party of Jacob Zuma, which is like Cope in reverse of a few years ago when Cope emerged out of the ANC. We're not exactly sure where they're going, what they're doing. What you do see is in by-elections at the local level, they mobilize anything up to 28%, and that is in rural KwaZulu-Natal. The third issue that I think is very important and probably going to determine the outcome of the coming election is the level of urbanization. South Africa is now approaching a level of urbanization very close to 70%. So we've got a 30% rural population and a growing 70% urban population. Urban politics in South Africa is different from rural politics. If you're in the rural areas, then, sorry for that, you are highly dependent on government grants, traditional leadership, and so on. And the ANC still dominates that vote. But that's a shrinking vote. That's about 30% of the vote. The big challenge will be in our cities and big towns. Let me just take a sip. There we are. So that is a big fight coming up. And the fourth element is the challenges at the provincial level. But the provincial level is probably only significant in the Western Province or Western Cape, Gauteng, and KwaZulu-Natal. For the rest, the ANC can already determine that the other provinces, they will dominate.
Let me take a station break, give you a chance to get rid of those hiccups. I don't want to make light of the fact, I mean, that the argument might be that politics tends to make one sick, but We'll take a quick station break.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And we're back, and this is Brooke Spector with the Deep Dive, and my guest today is Theo Venter, and he's recovered quickly from his illness. He was going through the underlying issues. If I could sum it up, you're something of a supporter of the idea that identitarian politics are still governing South Africa to a considerable but not total degree, because urbanization itself is a driver of political change in this country. If, as you say, 70% of the country is now urban or suburban, that's a very different universe than where it would have been 30, 40, 50, 100 years ago, when it was primarily, in population terms, agricultural. And it mirrors the developments in many other countries. You look at the U.S., about 5% of the population is truly rural, and that vote as farmers doesn't matter all that much, even though they're politically potent in certain states. But let me turn you slightly to the question of the various remedies and ideas that the parties are proposing. How well do they mesh with the realities on the ground as you've identified them?
Yeah, well, since all the major parties have now presented their so-called manifestos, which you well know in the American sense is called a party platform or a whatever. I recently completed an opinion piece for Farmers Weekly, when I took all of these manifestos and the issues they want to address, and all of them basically addresses jobs or unemployment or poverty as number one or number two issues. Only the EFF that has nationalization and expropriation without compensation as number one. But if you look and you compare the survey research in terms of what really bothers people and what they really would like to hear, then you will see unemployment is very, very high up on the issue. The second thing is personal safety, crime, everything that has to do with crime, corruption, and the impact of corruption comes up very high in personal demands from people. And then you go to the political parties and you see they have had some interesting changes to their offering to political party. Again, the EFF is the exception. Their party platform is 259 pages long. I think it beats about 80% of all theses written at universities in terms of length. Nobody will read that. And the other parties, the ANC has trimmed it down to 6, the DA, I think, to 7, the Freedom Front also 6 or 7 points. So I think there's a big learning curve among parties to limit the offering. But most of them, like I said, realize that the economy, and of course, every political party promises to sort out Eskom. And in my article, I said that there's a concept in English, in the world that I'm operating, that is called a wicked problem. Now, a wicked problem is a funny kind of thing. It is a problem that you cannot solve. You can maybe manage it, but it is not solvable as such. And secondly, it integrates in a socioeconomic sense with a lot of other problems. So, for instance, if you solve problem A, you create problem B and C. So you must be very sensitive in dealing with these problems, these wicked problems. And most political parties right up there trying to solve, for instance, poverty. If you solve poverty by means of a grant, which about 28 million South Africans receive, a grant in some form or another, then you have other socioeconomic problems and societal ills and things that flow from that. And you develop a kind of a dependence from the state. And that's why before you saved me from my own cough, I wanted to say that the ANC dominated the rural vote, because if you receive a grant, which most do, and your person or your domestic life, where you live in the village, is determined by a chief or a traditional leader, then you're in a captured market for the ANC. And that is still the case. So if the ANC goes to an election, in my view, they have 30% of the vote in the back pocket. They start at 30, while the others start at zero. And then I give them another 5% for being government, because they can do things. They can dish out the foodstuffs, the T-shirts, the blankets, so to speak, which the other political parties can't do. And therefore, I think what they need to do is to look for 15% of votes in the urban areas if they want to reach 50%.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
We got to get a better hand signal. Okay, we are back. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector. And my guest today, Theo Venter from the University of the Free State. And just before we took a break, he was ticking off the percentage of the national vote that the current governing party can count as safely theirs, 30% from the rural areas, more or less, another 5% or so from beneficiaries of this, and an additional percentage of beneficiaries from that. That got me to about 40 some percent, if I'm correct. But that's 40 some percent's never a majority in my mind, and it means you have to have friends, or you have to do something else, or you have to promise the moon and the stars.
Well, I would say back to my first love, the development of scenarios, I would say that there are three or four small scenarios that one must consider in thinking about the election, and I'll be brief on everyone. The first scenario is that the ANC gets to 50% on their own. It is not inconceivable. They have the ability, and they've shown in the past that in the straight, let's say the last 2 or 3 weeks before an election, they can really, really open the taps, and they can do their thing. They also have probably the best logistics platform to get people to the polls, to the voting boxes, because on election day, that's a crucial thing to do. The ANC can do that. They have demonstrated in the past. So scenario one is they win on their own and get 50.1% of the vote. The second scenario is that they get into the 40s, let's say 45% of the vote. If they have that, then they have to search among a few smaller parties, 1 or 2% parties like the Patriotic Alliance, Mrs. De Lille, and so on, to join up and to give them a 50% majority. You can rule in South Africa if you've got 45%, but you need to elect a president at the first sitting of parliament, and therefore you need at least 50% of the vote to form a government. And they've got 2 weeks to do that. And then the third scenario is that the ANC drops down to about 40% of the vote, and then things change, because to get from 40 to 50, you need a big party. And this is where the gossip and the rumor mongering about the ANC and the EFF working together has emerged. A lot of people fear that kind of outcome. I'm not worried about it at all because I don't think the ANC will form a coalition with the EFF. The amount of animosity between members are just too big and too great. And then came in over the last 6 to 8 weeks, the MK party emerged strongly. They were there behind the scenes and suddenly they emerged. Now, if they do what they did in by-elections, MK can get anything from 5 to 7% of the national vote, because KwaZulu-Natal represents the second biggest province by population, with about 12 million inhabitants, of which about 7 million are registered as voters. So it's a sizable amount, especially in a proportional election. Now this interesting scenario emerged where the ANC says, okay, to get 50, let's talk to our previous comrades in MK, and then we get up to 48%, and then we bring in one or two smaller parties, and you form a government. In that scenario, I can't see Mr. Ramaphosa surviving, because that will be the one area where the EFF will work very hard, or MK, to get rid of Ramaphosa. And the fourth scenario is in the case where the ANC gets below 40%, and there's at least two or three surveys that I've seen that gives them 37%, 48%, that brings the pre-coalition pacts, the so-called multi-party charter, into play, where it then becomes a very, very competitive electoral outcome, where the two parties have almost the same kind of support, and then somebody like the EFF or MK, if they do make it to the election, becomes the kingmaker in this election. So that's why the uncertainty about this election outcome is so different from what I described in the beginning, that every election, seven of them, we had a big party, a second party that is significantly smaller, and a third party that is smaller than the second one. I think that design is going to change in this coming election.
So it is then a watershed moment. It is a crucial election, in spite of all the puffery that goes around about every election being the crucial election, the watershed. This one really is a watershed for a change. And
absolutely,
whatever happens this time around is going to govern what happens in the next several elections. In the American parlance, and I'm sure you read V.O. Key's book and writings, in which he popularized the idea of a realigning election, that is to say...
And that is not all. The election is significant, but if we take the election, which will take place on end of May, and we look 2 years into the future, then in 2026, about 18 months after the national election, we will have local government elections again. And I think the ANC, if they do badly in this election, the local elections will even be worse, because local government is the missing link in our governance structure. That's where we've got our biggest problems. And then at the end of 2026, beginning of 2027, the ANC's next conference is on. Cyril Ramaphosa will then not be re-electable as president of the ANC. Somebody else will take over. And the question is, will we then follow the same routine as with Zuma and with Mbeki? And that is, if somebody takes over the leadership of the party, then it's just a matter of time before the incumbent president is pushed out. So this election, in my view, is opening up a situation of absolutely realignment, yes.
Yeah, so it's a realignment in slow motion, in effect, over a three-year cycle. When I studied politics, I mean, the classic realigning election in America was 1932, but it was actually building on trends that had been visible for 10-year period before that. The Great Depression gave the final shove to that reelection, which takes me to another question. If all these trends are true, and if, as you say, the local elections become really important, the problem is that a lot of the problems that drive voters to distraction are effectively bread and butter, kitchen table, local issues. My water doesn't come out of the tap when I turn the tap on. The electricity, I haven't had any for 2 days. The sanitation workers have been on strike. Now, you can call those rich people's concerns, but everybody needs water and electricity and sanitation. And those are mirrored all the way through all kinds of other local civic services. And you get protests as a result. And if you get protests, that has an effect on the political process.
You are absolutely on my page on this one. I indicated, apart from the wicked problems that all parties try and solve, I indicated that we also a victim of what I refer to as the paradox of development. If you look at the 2022 census and the outcome, you'll see that 85% of South Africans live in formal housing. 90% of South Africans has got access to electricity. About 80% of South Africans has got access to piped water. And then your point, if you have access to those things, it's part of your normal living, and it dries up, or the batteries go down or whatever, then frustration builds up. So we are in this process where development is not progressive. It's sometimes also a deconstruction in a part.
I have to break again. We have to do a message, commercial message, give our sponsors and supporters their due. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, my guest today, Theo Venter, and we're parsing the future on electoral politics in South Africa.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
I am indeed. That's who I am. I look down here and it says so. That's who I am. You get confused. There are too many wheels going on here today. My guest is Theo Venter from the University of the Free State, and we have been ranging wide and free over the electoral landscape of South Africa. But he spent some time in the United States as a political science government student. And I want to sort of throw him a curve because this is the year of elections. We've had the Indonesian one. We'll have the Indian one. We'll have the Russian one. No points for predicting who wins the Russian election. But I want you to, just for a minute, what's your reaction to what you see going on in the United States with our elections?
It's fascinating to see what goes on in the United States. And there are two or three points that I picked up in being a close student of American politics. Ever since I studied there, it became kind of my second love. And that is, I've never seen a leader of any of the two parties. Now, we know American politics, the leadership is a very fuzzy kind of thing. It's not the strong kind of leadership that you'll get in British politics or South African politics or whatever. Donald Trump, ever since he left office, stayed in control in one way or another of the Republican Party or the Republican National Committee or whatever you want to call the structure. That, to me, was unique. Secondly, as a possible candidate, his influence through the House of Representatives and in some cases the Senate was tremendous, even though he wasn't elected. And then after the Iowa caucuses and I saw the numbers, I was hoping that Nikki Haley can stay in longer, but it was clear that she was a lightning rod. And by Super Tuesday, it was clear that it's going to be a Biden-Trump kind of contest. And that seems to be the case. What bothers me is that neither the Republicans nor the Democrats have got a plan B. They've got two old candidates, and age is a big risk. In the case of Biden, it is more pronounced, especially in the media, but Trump is 77. That's also old. So what bothers me is that who comes in if something goes wrong? And however much I understand of American politics, I'm not sure whether in history we've ever had that a president in the running up to an election, for some reason or another, had to bail out due to illness or whatever can happen. So I'm fascinated, and I'm worried that if Trump takes over, in an article I wrote about American politics, I had a last question. They sent the article back and they said, can you put in a last question or a last point? So I said, yes, my last point to the Americans are, you've got 10 months to get used to Trump.
I'm going to have to break at this point because we've just run out of time. I'm worried too, by the way. This has been the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector, and my guest today was Theo Venter from the University of the Free State. We've covered South African politics, the world, and in the last couple of minutes, American politics. Join us again next week for another discussion with somebody else who knows things and can explain them with exquisite and interesting detail. We'll talk to you again next Friday. Have a good weekend.